A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Picture yourself walking into a medieval library. You push open the heavy wooden door, expecting the kind of tomb-like silence we take for granted today. And instead it hits you, a low, constant hum. Not chaos, not shouting, but dozens of voices murmuring at once. Every reader with a book in front of them is moving their lips, whispering the words, some half-singing them under their breath. It would have sounded less like a library and more like a beehive.
That sound was completely normal for over 1,000 years. Our whole assumption that reading is this private, silent thing you do inside your own head. That's the historical oddball. It's a very recent invention, and the story of how we got there is a story about how technology rewires the brain.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a question that stops you in your tracks once you really think about it. Was it actually true that people used to read books out loud, and that silent reading was considered strange? And the follow-up, would someone read out loud even when they were completely alone, with nobody else around to hear them?
Which sounds like it should be easy to answer, and then you start pulling on the thread, and you end up in neuroscience labs and medieval monasteries and Augustine's living room. It's a fantastic question.
Before we dive in, quick note. This episode is being written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, so if anything sounds unusually intelligent today, that's why.
I was going to say, if anything sounds unusually eloquent, I'll take the intelligence credit myself, thank you.
So let's get into this. The short answer to Daniel's question is yes. It's broadly true that reading aloud was the default for most of Western history, and silent reading was unusual enough that when someone did it, people remarked on it. But the real story is much stranger and more interesting than that simple yes suggests.
Right, and the place everyone starts with this is Augustine of Hippo, around the year 384. Augustine was visiting Milan, and he went to see Ambrose, who was the bishop there. And Augustine writes in his confessions about something that absolutely stunned him. He walks in on Ambrose reading, and Ambrose is just sitting there, eyes moving across the page, not making a sound. His lips aren't moving. There's no murmur. And Augustine is practically gawking at this.
Which is a wild thing to imagine, that one of the great intellectuals of the late Roman Empire found silent reading so remarkable that he had to write it down. He describes it like he's witnessed a magic trick. Ambrose's body is still, his voice is silent, but his mind is clearly consuming the text. Augustine speculates that maybe Ambrose was preserving his voice, or maybe he just preferred to read that way. But the very fact that Augustine feels the need to explain it tells you everything about what was normal at the time.
That passage has been debated by scholars for decades. Some argue Augustine was actually describing something more nuanced. Maybe Ambrose was reading in a low murmur and Augustine just couldn't hear it from across the room. Or maybe what struck Augustine wasn't silent reading per se, but the fact that Ambrose was reading alone and not sharing the text aloud with visitors, which was the social expectation. But even with those caveats, the core point stands. Silent reading was rare enough in late antiquity that one of the most learned men in the empire found it noteworthy.
That's our starting point. But the question Daniel's really asking goes deeper. Was this just about social performance, or was there something about the physical act of reading that made silence nearly impossible? And would people actually vocalize when nobody was around?
To answer that, we have to look at what a book actually looked like in the ancient world. Because it wasn't anything like what we picture. A text in, say, 2nd century Rome was a scroll, a continuous roll of papyrus with no punctuation, no paragraph breaks, no chapter headings, and crucially, no spaces between the words.
That lack of spacing is really the core puzzle Daniel's handed us. The claim that people used to read out loud, is it historically accurate? Or is it one of those things that gets repeated until everyone believes it? But the reality is messier.
It's messier, but the broad claim holds up. For most of Western history, reading was understood as an oral act. The default mode wasn't eyes scanning a page in silence, it was voice-producing sound, even if that sound was just a murmur. And the evidence for this isn't just Augustine's one anecdote. It's baked into how texts were physically constructed.
Right, you ended on that point. No spaces between words. Which sounds like a minor formatting quirk until you actually try to read something written that way. I did this once, just as an experiment. I took a paragraph of normal English, stripped out all the spaces and punctuation, and tried to read it silently. My eyes immediately snagged. I couldn't glide across the line. I had to stop and sound out each cluster of letters in my head. And within about 10 seconds, I was actually mumbling under my breath without even realizing I'd started.
That's exactly the point. You ran a one-person replication of 1,000 years of reading history in your kitchen. The physical format didn't just encourage vocalization, it practically demanded it. The technical term is scriptio continua, continuous script, and it was the standard format for Greek and Latin text well into the early medieval period. Imagine a page that's just an unbroken stream of capital letters with no punctuation, no paragraphs, no visual landmarks at all. Your eye can't scan ahead, you can't recognize word shapes at a glance. The only way to parse where one word ends and the next begins is to sound it out.
The physical layout of the text forced you to vocalize. It wasn't a preference, it was practically a requirement. And that makes me wonder, when we say sound it out, what did that actually sound like in practice? Were people reading at full conversational volume? Or was it more of a mutter?
The evidence suggests it was usually a low murmur, what the Romans called murmur or musitatio, not a full-throated performance, but definitely audible. Think of the way someone today might read a confusing set of assembly instructions for furniture. That half-whispered, okay, insert the cam lock into the pre-drilled hole, you're not announcing it to the room, but sound is coming out. That was the default reading mode for centuries.
Which means the medieval library wasn't a beehive of oratory. It was a beehive of people quietly talking to themselves, which is somehow even stranger to picture.
That's the key insight from scholars like Paul Singer, who wrote the definitive book on this, Space Between Words, 1997. Sanger argues that silent reading as a widespread practice simply wasn't cognitively feasible until scribes started putting spaces between words. That innovation came from Irish monks in the 7th and 8th centuries. They were copying Latin manuscripts, but Latin wasn't their native language. They needed the visual help to parse the text. Once word separation spread to the continent, it gradually rewired what reading could be.
The timeline matters. We're not saying nobody ever read silently in antiquity. Augustine's surprise at Ambrose proves it was possible, just rare. The real shift took centuries.
That brings us to the second part of Daniel's question. Would people read aloud even when they were alone? The evidence suggests yes, and for reasons that go beyond the physical format of the page. Reading was understood as a spiritual and cognitive practice, not just information intake. The monastic tradition of Lectio Divina, divine reading, treated the spoken word as essential. You weren't just decoding meaning, you were embodying the text through breath and voice, even if you were by yourself in a cell.
Which makes intuitive sense when you think about how memory worked before cheap writing materials. If you're reading something important and you want to retain it, saying it aloud reinforces it through multiple senses. You're not just seeing the word, you're feeling your mouth shape it, you're hearing it with your ears, you're building a richer memory trace.
We'll get into the neuroscience of that later, because it turns out your brain still does this even when you think you're reading silently. But the historical picture is clear. Reading alone did not mean reading silently. Those were two separate concepts that only merged very recently, so let's get concrete about what scriptio continua actually demanded of a reader. Paul Singer's research shows that ancient and early medieval readers literally could not scan ahead. The eye movements required for modern silent reading depend on being able to jump to the next word boundary before you finish processing the current one. Without spaces, you're forced to process letter by letter, sounding out each syllable to identify where the breaks fall.
Which means reading was unavoidably slower and more laborious. You're essentially decoding in real time, and the most natural way to do that is through your vocal apparatus. It's like the difference between reading sheet music and hearing someone play the piece. A trained musician can look at a score and hear it in their head, but that's a highly specialized skill. For most people through most of history, the page was more like musical notation that you had to perform to understand.
Sanger documents this with actual manuscript evidence. he tracked the introduction of word separation across hundreds of surviving texts and found it spread from Irish monastic centers like Iona and Lindisfarne in the 7th century, then gradually to Anglo-Saxon England, and finally to the continent by the 10th and 11th centuries. It wasn't a clean flip of a switch. Different scriptoria adopted it at different rates. But by the 12th century, word separation was standard across Western Europe.
The Irish monks who started this weren't trying to invent silent reading. They were just trying to read Latin more easily, since it was a foreign language to them.
It's one of those historical accidents, a practical solution to a local problem that ended up transforming human cognition. And once word separation became standard, you start seeing something new in the historical record, descriptions of people reading without moving their lips. By the 12th and 13th centuries, in the new universities at Paris and Oxford, silent reading becomes a described skill, not a curiosity.
This connects to the rise of scholasticism, right? The universities needed to process enormous amounts of Aristotle and other newly translated texts quickly.
That's Sanger's core argument. The shift to silent reading wasn't driven by the printing press. That came 3 centuries later. It was driven by the demands of university scholarship in the 1200s. When you're a scholastic philosopher trying to compare Aristotle's physics with his metaphysics and cross-reference commentaries, you need to read fast, and you need to read silently because you're doing it in a library surrounded by other scholars doing the same thing. Oral reading was too slow and too disruptive for that kind of work.
I want to pause on that image, because it's such a vivid turning point. You got a room full of scholars in Paris around 1250, and for the first time in history, a library is actually quiet. Not because someone imposed a silence rule, but because the technology of the page and the demands of the work had aligned to make silence the efficient choice. It must have felt like a superpower to the first generation that could do it fluently.
We know it felt notable because people wrote about it. Thomas Aquinas, according to his contemporaries, could read silently with remarkable speed. His secretary reported that Aquinas could dictate to multiple scribes simultaneously while reading silently from a text, a kind of cognitive multitasking that would have been unthinkable 2 centuries earlier. He was essentially using silent reading as a mental workspace in a way that oral readers couldn't.
Silent reading didn't just change how people consume text, it changed how they thought with text. It turned reading into a private mental sandbox where you could manipulate ideas without the bottleneck of speech.
That still leaves the question of what happened when those scholars were alone. And I think this is where Daniel's question gets really interesting, the distinction between reading silently and reading aloud in private.
Because the scholastic shift explains why silent reading became the norm in institutional settings. But Daniel's asking about the person alone in a room with a book. Does the habit of vocalizing persist even when there's no practical reason for it?
The monastic tradition of Lectio Divina is the best window into this. For Benedictine monks, reading was never just about information extraction. The rule of Saint Benedict prescribed specific times for reading, and the practice was always vocalized. You are meant to murmur the words, to taste them, to let them resonate physically. Even if you were alone in your cell, you read aloud because reading was understood as a form of prayer. The breath carrying the sacred words was part of the spiritual act.
There's a practical layer, too. If you're memorizing scripture, which monks did constantly, vocalizing embeds the text in auditory memory as well as visual. You're giving yourself multiple retrieval pathways. It's the same reason you still remember song lyrics from 20 years ago, but can't recall what you read in a newsletter last Tuesday.
We see this in descriptions of medieval scriptoria, the rooms where monks copied manuscripts. These weren't silent. Monks would dictate to themselves as they copied, murmuring the words they were writing. It was partly to maintain accuracy, partly because that's simply what reading and writing were. The idea that you could transfer text from one page to another in complete silence would have seemed bizarre to them.
When Augustine describes Ambrose reading silently in 384, it's not just a social anomaly. Ambrose was bypassing what most people would have experienced as a necessary step in comprehension. It would be like watching someone solve complex math problems entirely in their head, without writing anything down. Possible, but remarkable.
That's the nuance Sienger and other scholars have added to the Augustine story. Silent reading did exist in antiquity. We have other scattered references to it. Julius Caesar was said to be able to read silently while others spoke around him. But it was an elite skill, not a cultural norm. What changed between the 7th and 13th centuries was the infrastructure of the page itself, making silent reading accessible to ordinary literate people.
The parchment had to change before the brain could change.
That's beautifully put, and the brain did change. But that's where we're heading next. We left off with the parchment changing before the brain could change. But the question of what people did when they were alone, that's where this gets wonderfully weird. Samuel Pepys, the famous diarist in 1660s London, records reading aloud to himself at home, not performing for anyone, not in a group, just him and a book, vocalizing.
Pepys was a highly literate man, naval administrator, member of parliament. He wasn't some marginal figure clinging to an old habit. Reading aloud alone was normal for him. And he's writing this in his private diary, so he's not performing for us either. He's just noting what he did that evening. Read aloud to myself is as unremarkable to him as had supper or went to bed.
It stayed normal for a surprisingly long time. Conduct manuals from the 18th century still give advice on how to read aloud properly in private, how to modulate your voice, how to pronounce words correctly when you're reading to yourself. Which tells us two things. People were still doing it, and it was considered a skill worth cultivating.
Wait, conduct manuals gave instructions for private reading? What kind of advice were they giving?
Things like not mumbling, articulating clearly even when alone, varying your tone to match the sense of the passage. The assumption was that reading aloud, even in solitude, was something you did well or poorly, and doing it well was part of being a cultivated person. It's a mental framework that's almost completely vanished today. We don't think of silent reading as something you can be good or bad at in a performative sense.
The printing press, Gutenberg, 1450s. It didn't just flip a switch from oral to silent reading. What actually happened?
The printing press made books cheaper and more available, but it didn't immediately kill oral reading. What it did was create new kinds of social reading. In the 17th and 18th centuries, you get this explosion of reading aloud in groups. Families gathering after dinner to hear the latest novel, coffee houses where someone would read the newspaper to the room, literary salons in Paris where poetry and philosophy were performed.
Reading became a shared entertainment medium, which is almost the opposite of what we'd assume. We think more books means more people reading silently by themselves.
For a good two or three centuries after Gutenberg, the most culturally visible reading was oral and social. Jane Austen's novels, for example, were often read aloud in drawing rooms. People would gather and someone would perform the book. It was a social ritual, not a private escape. And this shaped how novels were written. Authors knew their work would be heard as often as it was read silently, so they wrote for the ear as much as the eye.
That's fascinating. So the rhythms of an Austen sentence, the way dialogue is structured, the pacing, it's partly engineered for someone to perform it in a room full of people. That's a completely different design constraint than writing for a solitary silent reader.
You can see the transition happening in real time if you compare 18th century novels to late 19th century ones. The earlier ones have more markers of oral performance, direct addresses to the reader, rhetorical questions, places where the narrator pauses to comment on the action. By the late Victorian period, those devices fade. The narrator becomes more invisible, the prose more interior. The book is now designed for someone alone in a chair, not someone holding a room.
When does the big shift to silent reading as the norm actually happen?
The 19th century is where it really locks in, and the key institution is the public library. In the 1800s, as public libraries spread through Britain and the United States, they started enforcing strict silence. This was a deliberate cultural project. Quiet was framed as a sign of literacy, discipline, and moral seriousness.
The architecture reflected that, right? The silent reading room becomes this sacred space. You can still feel the residue of that today. The librarian who shushes you. The almost religious hush of a university reading room.
By 1900, almost every public library in the US and UK had formal rules banning conversation. You can find the actual rule sheets from the period. No talking, no whispering, no humming. Silence was mandatory. And this was a radical departure from what libraries had been before. In the medieval period, they were filled with murmuring, and in the 18th century, they were often social spaces. The Carnegie libraries built across America were literally designed with separate rooms for different noise levels, the main reading room for silence, and smaller rooms where conversation was permitted. The architecture encoded the new norm.
Within a few decades, the cultural expectation completely inverted. Reading silently went from being an elite skill to being the baseline of polite behavior. And if you couldn't do it, you were marked.
You can track this in how people describe bad readers. In the late 19th century, if you moved your lips while reading, you were marked as uneducated, a poor reader. The same behavior that would have been completely unremarkable 2 centuries earlier became a sign of backwardness. School systems started actively training children to suppress vocalization. Stop moving your lips became a standard classroom correction.
Which is a pretty dramatic reversal when you think about it. For most of human history, moving your lips while reading was simply what reading was. Then, within about 2 generations, it became a defect.
That reversal maps perfectly onto the spread of compulsory education. Schools needed to process large numbers of students through standardized texts efficiently. Silent reading was faster, quieter, and easier to manage at scale. So it became the goal, and oral reading was demoted to a special activity. Reading aloud as a performance for the class, not the default way you engaged with a page.
Which brings us to the brain. Because it turns out we never really stop reading aloud. We just internalized it.
This is where the neuroscience gets fascinating. Subvocalization. That little voice you hear in your head when you read is essentially silent speech. Your laryngeal muscles actually make micro-movements when you read, even though no sound comes out. Most readers experience this, and it's not a flaw. It's a vestige of oral reading that your brain still relies on for comprehension.
Even when I'm sitting here reading silently, my throat muscles are twitching as if I'm about to speak.
Researchers have measured this directly with electromyography. They put sensors on the larynx and detect tiny muscle activations during silent reading. Your brain is sending the motor commands for speech just at a level below the threshold that produces audible sound. You're essentially miming the words at a microscopic scale.
There's that study you mentioned earlier, the 2023 one?
Right, the Yao et al. Study published in the Journal of Neuroscience. They used fMRI to track brain activity during silent reading and found something striking. Silent reading activates the left superior temporal gyrus. That's the same region that processes auditory speech. Your brain is literally hearing the words, even though your ears aren't receiving any sound. The auditory cortex lights up as if someone were speaking.
On a neurological level, silent reading is just oral reading with the volume turned down. The same circuits fire. The motor output is inhibited, but the cognitive processing is nearly identical.
This tells us something profound about how plastic reading is as a cognitive skill. Reading isn't a natural function of the human brain, the way spoken language is. It's a cultural technology reinvented only a few thousand years ago. Every literate brain has to repurpose existing neural circuitry. The auditory cortex didn't evolve for reading, but reading colonized it. We borrowed the speech processing machinery because that was the closest thing we had.
There's no dedicated reading module in the brain. It's a patchwork of repurposed systems. Visual processing, auditory processing, motor planning, all yoked together for a task they didn't evolve to do.
And that's why the history of reading isn't just a cultural story, it's a neurological one. When Irish monks started putting spaces between words, they weren't just changing page layout. They were creating the conditions for a new kind of neural pathway to develop. Word spacing allowed the visual system to do more of the work, which reduced the cognitive load on the auditory and motor systems, which eventually allowed those systems to go partially offline during reading. The brain didn't change first. The page changed, and the brain followed.
Which means, when we talk about the history of silent reading, we're really talking about the brain gradually learning to suppress the motor output of speech while keeping the cognitive processing. That's not a trivial rewiring. That's a major reorganization of how sensory and motor systems coordinate.
Some people never fully suppress it. There are individuals who still move their lips when they read or who find they can't comprehend dense text without hearing the words internally. We pathologize this now, but historically it was just reading. The fact that some brains resist full internalization isn't a defect. It's a window into what reading was for most of its history.
Daniel's question, would people read aloud even alone? The answer is yes, for most of history, and in a neurological sense we still do. We'd just learned to be quiet about it. And that brings us to the practical angle. For anyone listening who came for the practical angle, the claim that people used to read out loud in silent reading was unusual. It's broadly true, but the version you hear in cocktail party trivia oversimplifies it. Silent reading existed in antiquity. It just wasn't the norm. The norm shifted over centuries, not overnight.
The shift was driven by concrete things. Word spacing, university scholarship, library architecture, not some vague evolution toward better reading. What I find compelling is the cognitive layer. Reading aloud wasn't just a social habit people hadn't outgrown. It was a genuine tool for comprehension and memory, especially when text had no punctuation, no paragraphs, no spaces between words.
Which means that if you're struggling with a dense text today, a philosophy paper, a legal document, some impenetrable terms of service, and you find yourself wanting to murmur the words, that's not a failure of reading skill. You're tapping into a strategy with a 2,000-year track record.
We have the neuroscience to back it. That auditory cortex activation during silent reading isn't decorative. Your brain is processing the text more richly when it hears it. Reading aloud adds another modality. You get the visual, the motor, and the auditory all reinforcing each other. It's why monks memorized entire psalters by vocalizing them in their cells. They weren't just being pious. They were using the most effective memory technology available.
I've noticed this myself with really technical material. If I'm reading something dense and my eyes start skating over the surface, actually speaking the sentences forces me to slow down, pass the clauses, notice where the argument turns. You can't skim while vocalizing. The voice imposes a speed limit that the eye, left to its own devices, will gleefully ignore.
That's exactly what medieval readers understood intuitively. The voice was a comprehension governor. It imposed a pace that the eye, left to its own devices, will abandon. Modern speed reading culture treats this as a bug, but it's a feature. There's a reason you can read 3 pages of a novel in 2 minutes and retain almost nothing. Your eyes moved across the words, but your brain never really engaged. Vocalizing prevents that.
This isn't just about comprehension in the moment. There's research showing that reading aloud improves long-term retention. The production effect. The finding that saying words aloud makes them more memorable than reading them silently is one of the most robust effects in memory research. You're essentially tagging the memory with multiple sensory signatures.
The practical takeaway is almost absurdly simple. If a text is beating you, read it out loud. You're not being weird, you're being historically literate. You're using a technique that Augustine would recognize, that Benedictine monks built their spiritual practice around, and that your own brain is still trying to do anyway, just below the threshold of hearing.
Here's the open question I keep coming back to. For centuries, we moved from oral reading to silent reading as the mark of a serious literate person. But look around now. Audiobooks are exploding, text-to-speech is everywhere, people are listening to articles rather than reading them. Are we circling back?
It's a genuine reversal, and the numbers bear it out. Audiobook revenue has been growing double digits year over year for more than a decade. Voice interfaces, Siri, Alexa, whatever, they've trained a generation to expect information through their ears. But it's not the same as historical oral reading.
Right, because the social context is completely different. Medieval oral reading was often communal. The listener and the reader were in the same room. Now you've got millions of people each alone with earbuds in, being read to by a voice they'll never meet. It's oral consumption without the social presence.
The AI voice interface layer adds something stranger. When you ask a large language model a question and it speaks back, you're not reading and you're not being read to in the traditional sense. The text didn't exist before you asked. It's generated speech responding to generated text. That's a genuinely new thing. The author is a statistical model. The reader is a speech synthesizer, and you're the audience for a performance that was assembled in real time from probability distributions.
Which might normalize something that looks like reading aloud again. But in a context where the reader is a machine, and the listener is a human who may or may not be paying full attention, that's a long way from a monk murmuring psalms in a stone cell.
The medieval monk vocalizing scripture in his cell was doing something cognitively active. The voice was a tool of deep engagement. The risk with AI voice interfaces is that they make listening passive. You could half attend to a summary while doing dishes. That's not the same cognitive mode at all. It's the difference between singing a song and having a song playing in the background.
We might end up in a world where oral reading is everywhere again, but for almost opposite reasons. not for deeper comprehension, but for convenience. The voice becomes a way to bypass the effort of reading rather than a way to deepen it.
That's the tension worth watching. The technology that makes reading aloud unnecessary also makes listening effortless. Whether that's a return to something ancient or a departure into something shallower depends entirely on how we use it. You can listen to an audiobook with the same deep attention a monk gave to scripture, or you can let it wash over you while you scroll. The technology doesn't decide, the posture of attention does.
That posture is something we've been negotiating for 2,000 years. Augustine watching Ambrose read silently, trying to figure out what was happening inside that still body. He was really asking about the relationship between the physical act of reading and the mental act of understanding. We're still asking the same question, just with different tools.
The tools change, but the fundamental puzzle doesn't. What does it mean to truly absorb a text? Is silence better, or is sound? Is the voice essential, or is it optional? Every era answers differently, and the answer always reveals something about what that era values in the act of reading.
Something to murmur about.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The salt flats of Turkmenistan's Karabogazgul Lagoon act as a natural parabolic reflector, and in the 1930s, Soviet surveyors reported that on windless summer days, the flats could bounce sound waves so precisely that two people standing a kilometer apart could hold a whispered conversation. The effect is caused by a temperature inversion layer that forms above the salt crust, creating an acoustic duct that channels sound horizontally with almost no dispersion. Local Turkmen shepherds apparently knew about this for generations and used it to coordinate herd movements across the flats.
There's a place on Earth where whispering travels a kilometer. That's the exact opposite of a medieval library. Instead of a room full of murmuring, you've got an empty desert where a murmur crosses the horizon.
Hilbert just gave us the acoustic inverse of our entire episode.
This has been My Weird Prompts, with thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. Find us at myweirdprompts.com.
Until next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.